It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickard, will be back with me on Monday. Coming up, from death with dignity laws to green burial and closer attention to end-of-life care, the once taboo topics of death and dying are seeing a growing conversation. We'll explore that conversation with WPR's own Steve Paulson. Now, for the first time since the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act last year, a federal appeals court has upheld state bans on same-sex marriage. Yesterday, the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati overturned lower court rulings to keep same-sex marriage illegal in Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky. This runs counter to the trend of appeals courts across the country ruling in favor of same-sex marriage. The ruling appears likely that makes it appear likely that the Supreme Court will take up the issue now that there's a contradiction among the lower courts. Last month, the Supreme Court declined to take up challenges to rulings in a number of states, including here in Wisconsin, making same-sex marriage effectively legal here. Central Times legal affairs correspondent Kimmy King joins us now. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. How are you?
Good. Well, this is the first appeals court in the country to uphold a ban on same-sex marriage. Did this surprise you?
Well, it is reversing the trend. And in fact, I think the thing that is interesting about it is that there had been such overwhelming support out of much more conservative regions in the United States, that is what is somewhat surprising. I mean, the 4th, the 7th, the 9th, and the 10th Circuit have all allowed same-sex marriage to go forward, and then the 6th Circuit comes in with this. And remember, there is a federal judge in Louisiana who had struck down, who had said that the states could ban same-sex marriage. I think it's also important to point out that that Sixth Circuit decision is a 2-1 decision, mm-hmm. and I think undoubtedly everyone is going to be looking to see whether or not the Sixth Circuit takes it up as an en banc review case where the whole circuit, all of the judges that sit in the Sixth Circuit, would sit and listen to the arguments and see if that 3-judge panel made the right decision.
What was the rationale from the 2-justice majority?
Well, one of the more interesting things about it, and you see this in the one judge's dissent who said that it reads more like a lecture on political philosophy, one of the points that was made was that because this is such a major change to how the states have operated in the past, that this ought to be something that we defer to the voters on, and basically made the argument for what we call judicial restraint. In essence, saying courts should not rush in where voters have already treaded. Now, one of the difficult things about that is that it's not just voter initiatives, but it's also been that courts have weighed in on it about fundamental rights. One of the things about voter initiatives that everyone always points out is that you have to be careful if you're talking about something that is a fundamental right. Recall that the South would have loved to have had a referendum on slavery, right? And so this concern that somehow the voters know best is always something that can create a concern if it's a fundamental right.
Now, looking ahead, does this mean the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, will finally take this up after declining to hear appeals in the past?
I think so. The only thing we know on this is that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had said there was no reason to take this case right now because there was no disagreement in the circuits. And I think especially given the fact that this decision came down after Election Day, it was the opposite direction of the other 4 circuits that have taken this up. It certainly is an indication that there may be a greater willingness to take this kind of battle on. So I think that's what everybody is going to be watching to see whether or not the court wants to sit it out and maybe let a couple more circuits weigh in before they actually take it up. But without a doubt, one of the things that the court looks at when it decides what kinds of cases to take is whether or not there is a split among the circuits. And right now we have a split, except you really basically only have 2 appellate judges and 1 district court judge going up against approximately 15 other you know, judges that have heard this case. Is that a true enough circuit split? Not clear.
Could it happen that the Supreme Court takes this up, agrees with this latest court ruling, and then overturns all those rulings that allowed same-sex marriage in so many states?
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting because the court is in an uncharted area here. And it will be a very, I am sure that right now there is a conversation and dialogue going on at the Supreme Court about how to handle this, because in the Windsor and the Perry cases, all the court had basically said is the federal government shouldn't get involved in regulating marriage because that's been reserved to the states. This is now different because you have states saying, yeah, and when it gets left to us, we are going to regulate it away. Understand that many of these initiatives were done 5, 7, 9, over a decade ago. And in that intervening decade, public opinion has changed. So I think that if the court does take it up, and I think they are going to take it up, I don't know that they're going to take it up immediately following this Sixth Circuit decision. They might wait for a couple more appeals that are working their way up in the ranks. But if they do, be ready, because what you will start see happening is there are going to be those states that pass new initiatives to allow gay marriage because public opinion has changed so much.
So what happens if the Supreme Court doesn't take it up in the meantime? Is it just a patchwork still?
It is a patchwork, and that's one of the things that is a concern that commentators are focusing to, is that you're really left at the mercy of whatever your state is about the kind of rights that you have, and that can create a concern. But be ready for this, because this is not just an issue about, I think, same-sex marriage. I think it is reflects a larger issue regarding federalism and the way in which the United States is changing and how we view the states. You know, it used to be that physician-assisted suicide, for example, was only legal in 2 states. It's now we're moving very quickly toward it being allowed in 4 states, and other states are taking it up. Look at the elections on Tuesday, where you had 3 states in D.C. legalize recreational marijuana. I mean, this whole notion of a patchwork of laws in the area that states regulate is going to do nothing but continue to increase.
Briefly, I wanted to ask you, the Supreme Court announced today that it's taking up a challenge to subsidies in the Affordable Care Act. What's at stake here?
So I'm going to once again make kind of the same argument I just made, and that is what is at the heart in the King versus Burwell decision that is going to be reviewed by the court is the extent to which the federal government can provide subsidies to those states that don't create medical exchanges. And once again, we have this idea of how much federal, what is the scope of federal control? What can the federal government do to encourage certain kinds of policies? And then what are the limits of where the federal government can intervene? And that's in essence what that case is about. Can the federal government give those subsidies to states that didn't adopt medical exchanges? And so it's the first volley, I think, in what are going to be several launches of volleys on the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's referred to, because certainly the new Republican administration has indicated that in Congress it has a mandate to try to limit affordable care. It's going to be interesting because this is certainly one of those areas that could be damning for the Affordable Care Act. And if the federal government was, you know, prohibited from providing those subsidies to the states, it would undermine the core base of Obamacare.
All right, Kemi, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you. You take it easy, guys.
We've been speaking with Kimmy King, Central Time legal affairs correspondent and associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Yesterday, for the first time since the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act last year, a federal appeals court has upheld state bans on same-sex marriage. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As a culture, we're seeing an upsurge in the desire to talk about death, from the act of dying to burial options. The death of Brittany Maynard last week is part of that movement. The 29-year-old terminal cancer patient chose when to end her life under Oregon's Death with Dignity law. Starting next week, one of WPR's national shows, to the best of our knowledge, begins airing its 5-part series on death. We'll be airing short pieces from the series here on Central Time, Wednesdays after 3:30. Steve Paulson joins us now to talk about the series and America's urge to bring death into the open. He's the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, it is always a pleasure to be here.
Well, do I have that right? Is this a death moment? We're more comfortable or want to be more comfortable talking about death?
You know, it is, I think. And you know, it's so strange because we all know that we all know we're going to die. And yet it is probably the one conversation that just about no one wants to have, is to talk about death. And so it's as if but there's sort of the sense now that we need to talk about it. It's kind of burst into our collective consciousness. And so you're seeing all kinds of things. You're seeing some best-selling books about death and dying. You're seeing this sort of upsurge in gatherings, public gatherings, where people come together to talk about it. There are death salons, death cafes. There are even death dinners where people come together. So yeah, it's definitely on people's minds.
So what is changing in our culture that's making us more open to this once almost taboo topic?
Well, there's a sense that that death has gone underground. That it used to be that, you know, we were, as a culture, we were much more exposed to it. And, you know, people would die in their homes. Death was sort of closer at hand. And now it's sort of been sanitized, you know, removed from daily life. It's, you know, it happens off in the hospital. And there are some problems that come as a result of that.
Well, let's get into those hospitals and talk about the medical profession. We've heard on this show from a Dr. Atul Gawande, a surgeon, who's trying to help open this conversation about death. And you're going to share a story of somebody who's looking at doctors yourself. Set that up for
us. Right. So we're going to play a few short excerpts from some of the interviews that we'll be featuring in our 5-hour series on death. And one of them is with a filmmaker, Michael Bernhagen, who, along with his co-producer, Terry Kaldsadal, they've put together these films called Consider the Conversation 1 and 2. And they're really about how doctors often avoid talking honestly about death and why this leads to sad and often tragic endings. And Strange Champs did this interview.
Well, here's the deal. I think it's really important that people recognize that American medicine's success at fighting disease and extending life has created a new problem. Where we die has fundamentally changed. Where did most people die 100 years ago? They died at home. Today, most of us can expect to die in a hospital or a nursing home.
Yeah, what are the figures? It's something like 90% of us want to die at home. I'm not getting the numbers right, but only 20% of us will be able to do that.
I call it the 80-20 rule. You know, the majority of us do want to die at home, and we do want to talk about it. But guess what? 50% of them are going to die in a hospital. 20% of them hooked up to a whole bunch of tubes and machines in an intensive care unit, and another 25% in a skilled nursing facility. So we got this big disconnect.
So there seems to be this mindset shift. Maybe we're at the dawn of it now, the idea that just because we can extend life doesn't mean we always should.
Right. And so there's this huge discussion about, are there better ways that that we could kind of manage that end stage of life? And, you know, when you think about it, death is normal. I mean, it to die is not a failure of the medical system, for instance. It's something that's going to happen to all of us. And so the question then is, what can we do to try to make that as good as possible? And then the other thing that I should mention is, I mean, there are financial repercussions mm-hmm. here. So often, you know, the final 10 days of someone's life in an intensive care unit, that can easily hit $200,000 or $300,000, you know, with all of the life-saving technologies that are thrown at people, and often just to extend a life maybe another few weeks or so.
This is one of those fascinating historical processes that we're in the middle of, because I don't think anybody ever said, hey, let's pay lots of money to extend our lives in a hospital bed for 10 more days or 10 more weeks. And yet here we are.
Right. And so, I mean, so part of this is having that conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, being open about it, you know, sort of diving into this discussion that, you know, that most people want to avoid. And, you know, I mean, I have to say, working on this radio series has been really kind of transformative for me. I know for some of my coworkers as well, because it's not anything that I really wanted to talk about that much. And then suddenly, you know, doing all of these interviews, and you realize, wow, it's you know, it's not only revealing. I mean, you're going places you'd never gone before, but it's pretty interesting too.
Well, I think that takes us to your next story that you're going to share with us. Set up. It's a psychotherapist who deals with these issues, who really puts herself front and center in this conversation.
Yes, yes. So her name is Lonnie Leary. She has been at the bedside of literally hundreds of people at the moment of death. I mean, this is what she does for a living. She counsels people. She counsels families. And it goes back to a sort of a tragic personal experience for her. When she was 13, her mother died all of a sudden, and her parents thought they were protecting her. You know, they didn't tell her anything about it. They didn't tell her that she had a terminal illness. One day her mother's at home, the next day she's in the hospital and she's dead, and Lonnie never had a chance to say goodbye, and it haunted her. And they didn't give her information, and so she basically, I mean, it shaped her life. And she, years later, I mean, she went into this profession as a counselor, you know, helping people who are dying. And she had vowed that when it came to her own father, that she would be there for him. And so she said that she would, you know, she was going to do everything she could to help her father out.
So I closed my practice and I closed my university class and I flew home to be his primary caregiver. And we began talking about everything. I laid it on the table and I asked him very direct questions such as, where do you want to be? Who do you want to be with you? Who do you not want to be with you? Even what do you want to be looking at? What do you want to be listening to? What do you want to be smelling? And let's make a bucket list. We don't know how much time you have left, but let's make this quality time. Let's make this the best time of your life. Let's make it intimate. Let's make it rich. Let's make it authentic.
There's so much in her story that speaks to issues people are raising now. And one of them right at the end there is, you know, not fighting a struggle against death at the end, but fighting to make life as good as it can be until the end.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this phrase that a lot of people use, a good death, which is kind of a controversial phrase. I mean, some people don't like it. Lonnie Leary prefers an authentic death. And part of her point is that having this conversation about death, it's not just with people who are dying. I mean, she says we should talk with our children about it. And I have to tell you that, you know, after I did this interview, I came home and talked with my own teenage children. And, you know, obviously you do things that are age appropriate here. But and she tells the story of how, I mean, she has talked, I mean, not surprising given her profession, but I mean, she's talked with her own daughter since her daughter was the age of 5 about this. And then her daughter is now, I don't know, about 30 or so. She works in the Coast Guard and does rescue missions out in the ocean. So very dangerous business. And, you know, Lonnie is sort of worried about her daughter. And she said one time they had a conversation, she asked her daughter, so, you know, If there was one way you had to die, what would it be? And her daughter said, you know, I'd like to drown.
Wow.
Which, I mean, yeah, wow. And for Lonnie Leary, it was this moment where she thought, oh, okay, I don't have to worry so much about what my daughter's doing. She's doing what she wants to do. If it were to end tragically, you know, that would be the way she'd want to go.
Well, she's looking to pull back the curtains on death. And then the third story you have to share is someone who's trying to bring at least the thought of death into our living rooms.
Yeah, so this is, you know, sort of an offbeat story. So this is a guy named Chuck Lakin, who is a woodworker and a home funeral director in Maine. And he has a very peculiar specialty. He builds coffins that double as pieces of furniture, which then, as you might imagine, turn into conversation pieces.
Actually, I think the first coffin was sort of a gimmick. I woke up in the middle of the night, and the idea came to me, for one, you can stand this coffin up with 5 shelves in it. It's a display cabinet. You can put it on its side, and the first, third, and fifth shelves turn 90 degrees. So you can use it as an entertainment center. And when you turn it on its back, the 5 shelves become the lid. One of my friends has one of those in her living room, and she just loves having new friends over for dinner, because it's some lull in the conversation during the evening, she'll drop in the fact that that's her coffin over in the corner, just to see what happens. You know, it always starts a conversation after the initial shock, of course.
those coffin furniture pieces, starting a conversation. Steve, you're looking to start conversations here on the series.
Yeah, and part of the point of playing that last bit of tape is these conversations don't always have to be depressing. Mm. They can be revealing. They can be transformative. They can change relationships. They can be funny at times. I mean, it's a difficult subject, no doubt about it, but it can be revelatory.
Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, pleasure.
That's Steve Paulson, executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. You can hear the first installment in the upcoming series on death starting next Wednesday at 6 here on Central Time, where we'll air excerpts from that series Wednesdays at 3:30. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. There's a good chance a lot of you are kind of like me when it comes to pie. You like it, you eat it when you get a chance, but when it comes to making your own pie, well, it sounds a little intimidating. On today's edition of Food Friday, we'll get some advice and inspiration. Award-winning baker and author Kate Lebo joins us today to share lessons in pie from her San Francisco-based pie school. Students learn how to create things like blueberry lemon verbena galette, cheddar-crusted apple pie, and the one she'll help us bake today, whiskey maple pecan pie. So put on your apron, bake along with Central Time. The recipe's on our Facebook page. Kate Lebo joins us now. Her new book is Pie School, Lessons in Fruit, Flour, and Butter. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you're a poet, you're a writer, and so, of course, you decided to start a pie school.
Well,
how did that happen?
Why not? Well, you know, by now I've got 2 degrees in creative writing, the undergrad and the extra grad. And both times I was about to graduate, I kept getting that classic question of an English major. So what are you going to do with that degree? Right? So this time I just started getting flip with it and saying, oh, I'm going to start a pie school. And then that started to seem like a good idea. I mean, why not start a pie school? Why not start a business? And so with the help of Danny Cohen in Seattle, who's a wonderful business owner out there, she kind of coached me through it. And I opened doors the month that I graduated in 2012.
So what is it about pie that captured your imagination?
You know, I think that it's it starts with the cliche, easy as pie, that that is to a lot of us actually a joke now. And so it was a mystery to me first why originally it was supposed to be easy and then why it was so hard. What I discovered through making it is that it's best made by hand. And so it is kind of mysterious in that the mystery ingredient is how you touch it, which is something everyone kind of can bring to the bowl in a different way.
We'll get back to the poetry, but let's get into that technique a little bit because this was new to me.
Right.
I've tried to make my own pie crust. Not so good. I usually buy one or make crisp or something like that. So 2 keys that I found out about just looking at your book earlier today. Don't soften the butter and work it. Don't knead it, but work it by hand. Tell us about both of those.
Okay, so we need cold fat. You can use cold leaf lard. You can use cold Crisco. You can use cold butter in any combination. My recipe calls for about 1/2 cup of cold fat. Needs to be cold because it needs to keep its shape. Just it needs to be slightly separate from that flour. So when you roll it out real thin, you get these layers of butter, these layers of flour, these layers of butter, and they poof in the oven and make flakes.
Mm-hmm. So and by hand now. Why does it have to be by hand?
By hand, I mean, you can get great crust by using a pastry cutter. That's kind of a way that people are more familiar with. But by hand, what happens is you can actually use your sense of touch and you look into the bowl in a different way when you've got your hands in it. It's like playing with the mud, but edible, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're using your senses to figure out what's going on with the dough rather than anxiously peering into your cookbook to see if you're following the directions. That's why by hand.
Now, when I've talked to people who do bread and they knead the bread and they talk about the physical sensation and the tactile nature of it, and that's part of what makes them love making bread so much, and I'm too chicken to do that, too. Is that part of the joy of pie making for
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. I like to get my hands dirty. Mm-hmm. And I, really love, that's where the love gets in, too, right? And also where everyone kind of has their own signature way of making it. I find in my classes, I can give you all sorts of tips and recipes, but the thing that makes you need to be in the room with me is the gesture, mm-hmm. how I move my hands. That takes 4 sentences to describe something I can just do with a flip of the wrist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So pie is a folk art. I think that's one of the reasons that we see or we hear the story of it being passed down by our grandmothers, by our fathers, right?
That Right, a lot of us feel that family connection. How important is that as a part of why pie is different than, I know, a lot of other foods out there?
Well, I think because of that handmade and nature of it and that gesture that you need to be in the kitchen standing next to your grandmother, your grandfather, whoever made it, to see how they touched it, really. You don't do that with a cake, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could mix up that batter with your hands.
Yeah, sounds messy, actually. So a lot of times people will approach a recipe, and sometimes I'll do this, a recipe like it's a scientific formula. Mm-hmm. Do not deviate, measure to the, you know, atomic level. Is that how your recipes work?
No. Yes and no. Okay, so I'm trying to kind of bridge this gap between baking as a science and cooking as an art. That's kind of a popular chestnut right now, which implies that baking needs to be really precise, but those cooks, they get to improvise as they want, as they will. But I found kind of through my training as a poet, I started to look at pie as a form, right? So, you know, like the way you would look at a sonnet has these ridiculous rules that you have to adhere to get to something really cool. And then often at the end, you throw something out, right? That's your improvisation. You can break the rules. Same with pie. So if you start to understand that pie, double crust fruit pie is crust, and it's fruit and filling, and both of those two elements have five basic ingredients to them, you can start to improvise at will.
Now, we've got a couple of your crust recipes on the Central Time Facebook page, and we've got whiskey maple pecan pie. Can you tell us about that one?
Oh, well, you know, in my family, we still make our pecan pie with Karo syrup at Thanksgiving, because that's how my grandmother likes it. Mm-hmm. But when we make the extra pecan pie in between Thanksgiving and Christmas, when she's not invited over, I'd like to get out natural sugars because they add so much flavor, mm-hmm. right? There's no reason that you have to stick to corn syrup. So we've got brown sugar, we've got maple syrup in there. You also use honey. And then, of course, a shot of whiskey. Why not? Warms everything up. Plus, then you've got a whole bottle you have to take care of somehow.
Right. Yeah. And rye whiskey, I think, is what you suggest for this one.
I love the taste of rye whiskey. It's a little less sweet.
Now, talk about the use of different sweeteners. You said the corn syrup, I think, is your last resort when you're sticking to the family custom. Mm-hmm. When would you go to honey or maple instead of the plain white sugar?
So that's a great question. I think about sweetener in terms of how it's going to frame the fruit. So what's most important to me about a fruit pie is the fruit. You cannot rescue bad fruit. Get good fruit. Often we're dumping sugar onto things to try to rescue bad fruit, and just don't even bother. You know, make that pecan pie, right? So I'll choose honey when I want to add a floral flavor, maybe to apples or to peaches or something. Brown sugar when I want it to be a little more caramely. White sugar is just a really good, classic, clean frame for that. That's kind of how I go.
Now, working with fruit, there are some fruits that I like to pre-cook a little before I bake with them. Well, rhubarb in the spring is a big one. I always try to like simmer that with a little sugar.
Oh, really?
Is that dumb? Can I just cook with it raw? Are there fruits that you want to pre-cook like that?
You can do what you want with
that.
Thank you. If you want to simmer it, that's fine. I don't take that step. I find that it's not necessary. Okay. With really fresh rhubarb, that's ready to go. Though with frozen rhubarb, it can get really kind of soggy, like a wet washcloth. Mm. And you want to let that thaw and get the extra water out. The only thing that I cook before I put it into the fruit that I cook before I put it into the crust is quince, right? Which is a relative of apple. It's really tough, but when you cook it, it becomes this beautiful floral, pear-y, delicious thing. But if you put it in there raw, oh man, you're not in for a treat.
I'm laughing because A, I've tried to eat quince raw.
Doesn't
work. And B, just a month ago I had some quince and was like, okay, I'm gonna simmer it this time with some brown sugar. And I walked away from it and all the water boiled away. And I ended up throwing with a pan and it all like crystallized onto the pan. Yeah. So no quince for me this year either. Well, you've written in your previous book, I think it was, that we can tell something about our own personalities by our pie preference.
Right.
What does our pie tell us about ourselves?
Well, I mean, for my first book is a commonplace book of pie. I call it a collection of facts, both real and imagined, about pie. And it just kind of takes for fun this idea that what you eat says something about who you are, right? Used kind of associations of different pies. So when I was thinking about blueberries, I was thinking about how they're ripe in July and how Violet Beauregard from Willy Wonka turned into one and became much less of a brat after she, you know, had to be rolled off stage, and ended up thinking about, so what kind of person would love this pie with all these things that kind of attend a blueberry?
So what's, like, what is your totem pie, I guess we'd say?
Oh, gosh. You know, I kind of... I think
you're agnostic, I bet. You like them all. Which one?
A banana cream pie is the one I feel closest to in that book. Mm-hmm. Not as a cook. I actually don't like making cream pie at all. That's for somebody else to do. I like to eat it.
Okay.
Rather than make it myself.
I don't know. I've got fruit pies I like. Blueberry. Actually, raspberry pie. Forget it. Raspberry pie is my favorite to eat.
That's a good one.
All right. Well, we are talking about pie making now, about the secrets of baking the perfect pie. And we want you to join our conversation. Do you have a secret for making a great crust? Or do you need some inspiration and advice to get you to try doing it yourself? What is your favorite kind of pie? Does that say something about you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, check out Kate Lebo's recipe for two types of pie crust and for whiskey maple pecan pie. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking pie now in this week's edition of Food Friday, and we'd like to hear from you. Is baking a creative journey for you, like it is for our guest, Kate Lebo? What do you need to get into the ideal pie-baking mood? And do you need some help, some advice, or do you have a pie secret to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Kate Lebo stays with us to share lessons in fruit, flour, and butter from her pie school and her book by the same name. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Allison on the line in Milwaukee. Allison, hi.
Hi, I have a question in regards to sugar levels in pies. I know that a lot of times baking is an exact science. And whenever I bake, I like to decrease the sugar. I don't like to add fake sugar. And for fruit pies where you do cook the filling, it's easy because you can kind of taste it to see if it's as sweet as you need it to be. But when it comes to maybe a cream pie or like a pecan pie, can you cut the sugar without losing the texture it's supposed to be? I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I tend to decrease the amount of sugar in recipes that I find elsewhere by about a quarter of a cup because I like tartar pie and I like less sugary pie. That said, children tend to not like my pie then. But you can get away with that and not mess with the texture of those pies.
Thanks a lot for the call, Allison. That reminds me, another ingredient I wouldn't necessarily have thought of. You say salt is often key. Not a lot, but a little.
Just
why
a
salt?
Little. Salt makes everything taste better. I find when I'm in the process of making filling, I have a step where I always taste it, just like the previous caller said, to see if it's got enough sweetener, to see if it tastes good. And often it's not that it tastes bad, it's just kind of bland. Hmm. And the thing to resolve that isn't more sugar, isn't necessarily more spice. It's a little more salt, maybe a little more lemon. That kicks up the flavor.
And you're talking a pinch or two.
I'm talking just a pinch.
All right. Back to our callers. Julie is on the line in Mesa Mani. Julie, hi.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Julie?
Well, first, I got to say that talking about pie means I'm probably going to run out tonight for dinner, and instead of buying a meal, I'm going to order slices of pie. I live for pie. But my grandmother from Richland Center is 96 years old, and she is the best baker who has ever lived. And she really kind of spoiled me as far as the ultimate pie. The secret that she had, and this was her peach pie, which is my favorite, is she would put cinnamon in with the peaches. Mm. But she didn't just do peach, but it was peach with a touch of cinnamon. And then she'd do the crystally sugar over the top of the crust, so you kind of got that sweet, crunchy bite. And there's just nobody else in the world that can bake a pie like my granny.
Have you tried to replicate it, Julie?
I've tried. Failed pretty miserably, but I think I put the same amount of love into it,
right.
Not the same amount of talent.
Julie, thank you so much. Good luck. You're going to get it right one of these days. A little cinnamon in peach pie. What do you think, Kate?
I was wondering if she puts in enough cinnamon that you can tell that flavor is there, if it's just that pinch. Mm. So you're kind of wondering, because that's a fun way to play the pies. Yeah.
And that reminds me, I mean, peaches, we get them, you know, local here in Wisconsin sometimes. Otherwise, sometimes we just get pretty mealy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
How about frozen peaches or frozen other fruit? Does that work for pie out of season?
Absolutely. And it's much more, if you want to make a fruit pie in the winter, that is the only way to go, because that's really all that's available. And the way to use that frozen fruit is to let it thaw just a little bit, so it's a little easier to work with. Some fruits benefit from thawing all the way and draining that water. Peaches is one of them, because they're so juicy. Mm-hmm. You can get extra and kind of get a really soggy bottom crust. Yeah.
Okay. Is it ever, I mean, if we put it in frozen too, does that ruin the cooking time of the crust? Does it keep it raw in places maybe?
You know, it makes you, it requires you to cook the pie just a little bit longer, which is, you know, that's 5 to 10 minutes. Eyeball it.
All right. Mm-hmm. Before we get back to our callers, I wanted to ask you mentioned earlier, I think, cheese in a pie crust.
Right.
And my question is, what?
Well, apple pie without the cheese is like a kiss without the squeeze.
Right, but I think a little cheddar, a slice of cheddar on top, but in the crust itself, that's what's getting
there. Absolutely. You mix in about a cup of shredded cheese, any kind of hard, delicious cheese, right before you put the water into the dough. And you roll it out just like any other kind of pie crust. I usually wrap it around not too sweet apples and bake it up just like a pie. It's delicious.
Wow, a perfect Wisconsin pie crust. Mm-hmm. We've got Diane with us now in Walworth. Diane, hi.
Hi. I have a recipe from my friend's grandmother, and for the liquid, it calls for an egg beaten with 5 tablespoons of water and 1 tablespoon of vinegar. And I don't know what makes it good, but it's really flaky, and it calls for lard for the fat.
Mm.
But one time I made a pie for the lady that I got the recipe from, and she said, "This is the best crust. This is really good crust." I said, "Well, it's your recipe."
Sounds fantastic.
Diane,
what does the vinegar do?
Diane, thanks. Yeah, vinegar and crust. Have you tried this?
I have tried that. So lard is what's making that super flaky. Mm. The vinegar helps cut down the gluten formation, which you don't want to knead pie dough because that causes gluten to form. Vinegar prevents that from happening. The egg adds just a little extra protein that helps it roll out really smooth. Also, as it adds richness. That sounds like a great recipe.
Well, speaking of gluten, some people close to us here at Central Time are gluten-free. Are there crust options? Can they enjoy a pie in this world?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've got an almond flour tart crust that I lean on like an old friend whenever I'm making pie for gluten-free folk, but also just whenever I'm making a tart because it's delicious. I do a buckwheat crust, use buckwheat flour. That's kind of a stronger flavor, so I use it with stronger flavored fruits like peaches.
And this is something even people who don't have to eat it will enjoy?
Yeah, absolutely. Always. Right. It's always the idea.
Back to our callers now. We've got Barb on the line in Milwaukee. Barb, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Barb?
Well, I wanted to mention that it's going to be 26 years this Thanksgiving. For 26 years, I've had an open house pie party.
Wow.
From 6 in the morning until noon.
Oh.
I get about 30 pies. My partner and I serve, you know, clean the house for weeks and bake up 30 pies that we buy at the store because we don't make all 30 pies.
Uh-huh.
And some people bring pies, and we just invite everybody and his brother, and it's just wonderful.
Fantastic. So and a lot of variety of different kinds of pies, Barb?
Oh, my God. Every kind you can imagine. Every kind.
And so you can leave your address when we put you on hold after this, Barb. We'll all
we'll
drop by. Yeah. Thank you so much. What a great story. So pie as a center of a social event.
Oh, always. I mean, pie itself is a social form, right? You can eat it by yourself. It'll be kind of like drinking a bottle of whiskey by yourself. You know, it might be fun the night before, but the next day you'll wake up feeling a little sad, right? Share it.
Yeah, we have on March 14th, we have a Pie Day celebration. Our news director, Michael Leland, is an expert pie maker, and he rallies people to bring in a bunch of pies. I always look forward to the 314,
right.
The pie. So do you do pie parties yourself, Kate?
I do. So I host an event called Pie Stand, where I will just make a bunch of pies, invite people over, invite them to invite their friends, and have a social. Sometimes I'll sell it. It was how I paid my rent in between years of grad school. I also do an event with my partner, Sam Ligon, called Pie and Whiskey, where, as you can imagine, we've got pie, we've got whiskey, we've got some fantastic writers reading short pieces. About 400 people come to this every year.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
They know where to go.
Two of my favorite flavors. We've got Rebecca on the line now in Black River Falls. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about when to pre-bake a crust and when to leave it raw. I always end up with a really nice crust on the side, and then it's really soggy or raw right in the middle.
Interesting.
your diagnosis, Kate?
Okay, so often I find that what's actually happening with the raw crust in the middle is that the person, and you can tell me if you're doing this or not, is leaving that crust on the counter to get kind of lukewarm, or might be leaving the crust on the counter with the filling in it, so the like while they're rolling out the top crust. That totally ruins, makes a soggy bottom crust. You can't rescue it. Always, if you are not touching that dough, leave it in the fridge. Okay, so you'll roll out your bottom crust while you're preparing the top crust and the filling. That bottom crust is in the fridge.
So what's happening is the butter or the fat melting,
yes.
Softening.
Yes.
Okay, so
that's
if
exactly
it's if you're
happening.
Not working with it now, it has to be in the fridge.
Yes, that's one of my little tricks.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you about this guy I'm holding here. Now I saw a bird thing that you kind of jam on the middle of a pie in your book. You've got you brought in a cow version of it. It's kind of a cylindrical thing that you would, I guess, stab into the middle of the pie. What do we do with this? What does it do?
So we were talking about pie birds, and what you've got in your hand is a pie funnel. It's
pie
a
funnel.
British version of our pie birds. And they're these little ceramic animals that are hollow on the inside. They've got a hole in the top of them. Usually the hole in the bird is right through its mouth. It catches steam from the baking pie and vents it out. So what I'll do is I'll set it in the center of the pie right onto the bottom crust before I put the fruit on, pile the fruit around it, and then I'll fold the top crust into fourths, just kind of trim the tip so that suddenly there's a hole, and I'll fold that top crust around it and then just bake as normal.
So it lets the steam out. What does that do? What's the good in
Well,
that?
You want to let the steam out because otherwise you're braising your fruit rather than baking it, basically, right? You'll that's when you take out your pie and the crust has risen like a parachute, but the filling is hunkering down low, right?
Oh, okay.
Right?
All
so
right.
You need to cut really big vents. Or have one of these funnels.
Is this for a particular type of pie or just any fruit
pie
that's going to help
you
out? Oh, interesting.
Whatever you want.
All right. So I think I mentioned up front, I like pie. I want to be able to make pie, but I always chicken out and make crisp or something a little more surefire. Can you give us a pep talk for people like me to actually try making their own crust and making some pie?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. So one of the things that I've learned through trial and error, through experience, is that pie cannot be made well. In large batches. I truly believe this, that the best pie is made in small batches by hand, which means that it is the territory of home bakers. The best pie that you're going to have is going to come out of your own kitchen, way better than you're going to ever get at a bakery. So get thee to pie school.
All right.
And give it a shot.
And work by hand.
Go by hand. Keep the water and the butter cold. Use a light touch. Go by feel.
All right, Kate, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with us
Thanks
today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be in Madison.
That was Kate Lebo. She's an award-winning baker, founder of the Pie School in San Francisco, and she's the author of the book, Pie School, Lessons in Fruit, Flour, and Butter. You can catch her at A Room of One's Own in Madison, where she'll be reading from her new book. That's Sunday, this Sunday at 2 p.m. I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.